Attacks on Israeli targets in retaliation for the regime's atrocities against Palestinians in Gaza. Thank you for joining us. Now, the Israeli military continues to pound the Gaza Strip, with one hospital alone receiving at least 120 dead bodies on Friday. The bodies were dispatched to the Indonesian hospital from across the besieged territory. One of the latest strikes targeted a school south of Gaza City, killing dozens of displaced people and injuring over 100. The Jabalia refugee camp and areas east of Rafah, as well as Khan Yunis, were struck too. The official death toll since October 7th is over 12,000, but Gaza's health ministry says it's increasingly difficult to document all the fatalities given the communication blackout and the collapse of the health system. Israel has also been raiding hospitals in recent days, claiming that Hamas uses the facilities for its operations. The resistance movement strongly denies the accusation. One of Gaza's hospitals hit hard by Israeli war is the Indonesian hospital in Beit Lahia in the northern part of the territory. Officials there say the facility is completely out of service due to a lack of supplies. They say the hospital cannot offer services despite receiving an overwhelming number of patients. There are currently 500 patients at the Indonesian hospital, while it has a total capacity of 140. That's according to the director of the hospital. Health workers also say they are facing a severe shortage of basic supplies, and it comes out as the hospital is also sheltering people from the nearby Jabalia refugee camp. Meanwhile, Israel continues its raid of the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza City. The director of the hospital says the medical complex has become a, quote, big prison and a mass grave for all those inside. According to Gaza's health ministry, 24 patients have died there in the past 2 days as vital medical equipment has stopped functioning because of power cuts. Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by our very own Colin Campbell from Washington, D.C. Now, Colin, I wanted to know your thoughts on what is happening on hospitals in Gaza, especially the siege on the Al-Shifa hospital. There's only a handful of hospitals operating right now, but that's just partially with an overwhelming number of patients and lack of medicine, food and water. And just recently, the director of the hospital says the medical complex has become a, quote, big prison and a mass grave for all those inside.
And what we know about Gaza was that it was already described as an open-air prison. And now you have thousands of people dying within this prison. And so the characterization of it becoming a mass grave, unfortunately, is very accurate. And you're hearing people really get upset over the realities on the ground in Gaza, especially here in the United States, where you see continued protests, especially in the city of New York, where you have seeming protests every single day. Most recently, they had protests in front of Penn Station and other areas of New York, including in front of the mayor's mansion, in front of various very prominent business buildings, where you had protesters that are urging, pressing, protesting, urging all of those for a ceasefire. They are demanding a ceasefire immediately because of the death toll that continues to rise. We understand that there are numerous people who have died, and the numbers of those people keep continuing to rise. And some have the estimates over 11,000 people. This seems obviously grossly disproportionate in the action that is being taken against, that is taken against any type of activity. And then you have those who are saying, listen, you are killing mostly women and children. And a huge percentage of children, because the population in Gaza is so young, these aren't adults that are dying. They're wiping out seemingly generations of Gazans, of Palestinians, as this campaign continues. When it comes to the hospital, we realize that there were already dire situations for the past several weeks. Since October, we've been talking about the number of hospitals that have shut down, the hospitals that have been running over capacity. And of course, now Al-Shifa is shut down, and they announced how they have run low on fuel. They're now just on emergency power. Meanwhile, you still have this blockade of emergency aid to get into these areas to help people out. Doctors there have had to make some very hard decisions, amputating limbs because they just simply didn't have the medication or the type of aid that would prevent infection from happening to try to save any appendages. So they're just now making decisions to just cut appendages off for these kids because there isn't any way to save them. This is very disturbing, obviously, as you see the images on our screen now of babies being carried and children who are being terrorized by these actions. And we're not even sure when it will end. And so you have people who are very frustrated. I've interviewed people who have literally cried in front of me because they're so grief-stricken and so outraged over what's happening in Gaza. And so we'll continue to see protests, but we'll also continue to see these images because we don't know when this campaign will stop. We don't know when this will all cease, but we do know that thousands of people have died, thousands of people are being affected. And this is going to last for generations. Even when the bombs stop, even when the shooting stops, the feelings will not end. The lost loved ones will not come back. And so the impact of this will be felt for years. And I really struggle to find how this ongoing campaign, these constant bombings, will actually bring a sort of peace in the future because of the loss of life, because of the anger, because of how this all began. And I'm not talking from October 7th. I'm talking from the late 60s, how this began, or even the late 40s, 1940s. So I really think that this is going to be a continued problem. And that is probably the most vexing out of this whole situation, is that what is going to be the future? How will this be resolved? And I have been very deficient on finding any thought leaders who actually have the answer for that question.
Colin, you said that we don't know when this will stop. So I want to ask you about the significance of these pro-Palestine rallies. We've had, in the past couple of days, we had rallies in the West Bank, Nablus and Al-Khalil, obviously in the occupied territories. We had in different cities in Amman. We had Amman in Jordanian capital. We had Nizwa as well in Oman. We had Bahrain, Lebanese cities of Beirut, Sidon, Madrid, Seoul, Japan, Bangkok, Australia, Germany, and also the US. I think we have demonstrations right now in New York and also Washington, D.C. So how significant have you seen these rallies up to now?
Yeah, these are very significant. And if I could put on my academic hat for a second, a lot of this is rooted in just social movement theory and social protest theory, where you have people who are so outraged over a certain incident that they're coming out in droves to call attention to it. And what you're seeing is the manifestation of frustration, of urgency, of sadness, despair, disappointment, all of those things. And a lot of it aimed at the West, particularly the U.S. government, because of their backing of Israel and what is occurring right now. So you have people who have called out Biden, who have called him a murderer, have called him guilty of genocide, just as much as Netanyahu. And what is interesting about this is we're seeing this more and more in a digital age. So before, when we saw these protests, I remember when I first started working with press back in 2008, there wasn't this ubiquity of social media. It was just starting to really take form with the platform formerly known as Twitter, now called X, where people were posting to it. And we did see some rumblings on social media, but nothing like what it is today. You have several different platforms who are showing these protests. They're showing the thousands of people that really amount to millions all over the world that are calling for a ceasefire, that are upset over the situations that are happening, and everyone is looking at this synchronously through digital mediated platforms. And this includes smartphones, of course, tablets, online, and it's hard to hide the atrocities of what's going on. And that's why I'm saying this will have lasting impacts, because we have to remember what is put online exists now in perpetuity. So the images you're showing now, people will find these images for generations to come. And it depends on the grace that maybe some people decide to give for what's happening, for just some of the horrid nature of what's going on. But we can't guarantee that's going to happen with everyone. You have families that are wiped out. You have legacies that are being wiped out and have been wiped out. And so with this, are the descendants of these people who are being so heavily affected, are they going to be very forgiving in the future? And again, there's a lot of blame to go around. You know, how is this going to take form? How will this ultimately bring peace? And that's why I'm saying that people I speak to, experts who have studied this area way longer than I have, really don't seem to have any cogent answers.
Colin, thank you for your time. There you have it, Colin Campbell from Washington, D.C. Thank you for your time, sir. Now, continuing with the rest of the news, international bodies have voiced deep concern about the ongoing humanitarian crisis in the besieged Gaza Strip. Let's listen to some top UN officials addressing a UN General Assembly meeting.
And the health system is near collapse. Only 10 of Gaza's 36 hospitals are still functioning, with just 1,400 hospital beds. Many health workers have been displaced, forced to flee with their families. Here is what that means. More and more casualties and fewer beds, health workers, medicines, and supplies. Premature babies dying as life support systems shut down. More than 2,000 patients with cancer, 1,000 with kidney disease, 50,000 with cardiovascular disease, and 60,000 with diabetes, all at risk as their treatment is interrupted. Up to 200 women giving birth every day in the worst imaginable conditions. An estimated 20,000 people and counting in need of specialized mental health services. Among displaced populations in overcrowded shelters, we are seeing increasing numbers of respiratory and skin infections. Cases of acute watery diarrhea as the sewage system breaks down and people are forced to defecate in the open.
We must be able to move from ad hoc delivery of assistance to a continuous flow of aid. It's like anyone in any society, in any village, in any community. Civilians need to have their essential needs met. They need to know when the next treatment or delivery will happen. They need to know it will be unimpeded, and they need to know that aid will arrive. Number two, more crossing points into Gaza for aid and, importantly, commercial deliveries of essentials. Addressing the scale of needs across Gaza from a single crossing point in the south, as now, is logistically impossible.
It is a fact that many civilians are unable to comply with the Israeli forces' instruction to move elsewhere in the face of imminent bombardment. Hundreds of thousands of people, including many children, wounded, and people with disabilities, remain in the north or other areas of intense military activity, including areas where humanitarian access has become impossible. Their lives must be protected urgently. The current Israeli proposal for a so-called safe zone is untenable. The zone is neither safe nor feasible for the number of people in need. I refer you to yesterday's statement by the Interagency Standing Committee. Civilians must be protected throughout Gaza, wherever they are. Also join my humanitarian colleagues in our alarm about the imminent total depletion of fuel supplies. Already, this is leading to the collapse of water, sewage, and crucial healthcare services, and could end the trickle of humanitarian assistance that Israel has to date permitted to enter Gaza.
The United Nations says Israel must stop using water as a weapon of war and should allow clean water and fuel into the Gaza Strip. The UN Special Rapporteur on Safe Drinking Water says preventing the supply of safe drinking water is, quote, in brazen breach of international law. Edro Arojo Agudo says this could have unimaginable consequences and could result in more civilian deaths than what he is calling the colossal death toll from the bombardment of Gaza. The UN has already said about or around 70% of the population in Gaza is drinking contaminated water. The world body has warned of a swift deterioration if Israel continues to block fuel from entering the Palestinian territory. Israel has allowed fuel into the Gaza Strip only once since the regime began its onslaught 42 days ago. The UN says the entire shipment covers only a fraction of the fuel needed every day for life-saving activities in Gaza. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah says it has hit at least seven Israeli targets in the northern parts of the occupied territories. In separate statements, Hezbollah said it struck targets with what it called appropriate weapons. An Israeli tank was also hit near the Branit barracks. The group said its attacks are in response to Israeli crimes against Palestinians in Gaza. Meanwhile, the Israeli regime shelled several areas in southern Lebanon. The area along Lebanon's southern border has frequently witnessed exchanges of fire between Hezbollah and Israel since October the 8th, a day after Palestinian resistance forces launched Operation Al-Aqsa Flood against Israel. Several Israeli settlements in the northern parts of the occupied territories have been evacuated due to Hezbollah's attacks. And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The number of Palestinian children confirmed to have been killed by the Zionist regime in Gaza is now approaching 5,000. As Gaza's hospitals are being attacked and forced to close and the health ministry is unable to update casualty data and huge numbers are trapped under the rubble, the real figure for child deaths is far higher, actually. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "Gaza's children are living through a horror movie during the day and a nightmare after dark. Gaza's children did not choose this situation. It was imposed on them by the Zionist regime. Gaza's children did not choose death. They have big dreams that they think about every day. They believe that their parents are superheroes who can make those dreams come true. Their parents have told the children that dreams can be realized when they grow up. But the reality, a reality imposed by the Zionist regime, is that so many children in Gaza do not grow up. They are killed before they can grow up. The children of Gaza are experiencing the worst days of their lives. They know that the Israeli regime warplanes are targeting them. It is by no means the first time that children have been targeted. Children comprised a large proportion of Gaza's martyrs during a major Israeli attack in May 2021. But the intensity of the current war is unprecedented. The number of children confirmed to have been killed is now approaching 5,000. As Gaza's hospitals are being attacked and forced to close, and the health ministry is unable to update casualty data, and huge numbers are trapped under the rubble, the real figure for child death in Gaza is far higher. Some of those killed were newborn babies. Is killing childhood in Gaza really the goal of Israel's war? Israel is displaying its inhumanity by robbing children of their right to live in peace. Children fear the sound of missiles and explosions. They are exhausted because they are deprived of sleep and rest. They have to move with their parents from one place to another. They hope to find safety, but there is none. Sarah Al-Saadi is aged 14. She said, "This is not a war. This is the extermination of children. How can the world look at the scenes of children under a rubble as if it is something normal? No one feels for us. I have not heard anyone saying, 'Stop the war for the sake of Gaza.' We live in terror every day. We are afraid of the sounds of missiles and the sounds of tank shells. They never stop." Sarah and her family have taken shelter in a school run by the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA. "They went there to escape death," she said. "We walked for a long distance under bombardment. The Israelis showed no mercy or pity to the children." Sarah has talked to other children at the UNRWA school about her experiences. She said, "We all need to speak and be heard. This is a very scary world. We are children, and like the other children of the world, we have the right to learn, the right to play, and the right to live in peace." Many children have written their names on their hands and feet. They have done so to ensure that if they die, they will not die anonymously. There will not be numbers. Many children cried before writing their names. They felt that death was approaching them. Reem Salama, 10, said, "I saw many videos of children who were torn to pieces. Nobody knew who they were. I saw pictures of children writing their names on their hands. That's why I sat in the schoolyard and wrote my name on my hands and feet. Other children came around and I wrote their names for them. I felt sad, but this is life in Gaza. Instead of learning, playing, watching TV, spending time at home, we are writing our names on our bodies. We are afraid that we will die without anyone knowing about us." Adults are struggling to offer children comfort as the Zionist regime's bombardment continues. Khaled Zakaria, 45, said, "This is a war against children. I cried so hard when I saw children writing their names on their hands and feet. Some of them asked me, 'Does this mean we are going to die?' I told them, no, this is just a game. Zakaria notes that problems associated with trauma, such as bad wetting at night and trembling during the day, are widespread. She said, the sounds of missiles frighten them a lot. They experience fear and anxiety all the time. If a missile falls next to us, they cannot sleep at all during the night out of fear that someone will target them. I have 5 children and they are all living through the same terrible experience. I just wish the war would end and I often pray for that. Children are unable to attend classes and routines that give their lives some stability have collapsed. Ahmad Abu Al-Raous said, I used to complain about how I had to wake up early for school. I couldn't wait until the weekend or until we had vacations. Now, I hope that the school will start again. I miss my friends, he said. I miss my grandfather and my grandmother and other relatives. I miss my home. We had to leave it because of the bombing. I am tired of sleeping in classrooms and searching for water for my family. I am tired of the sound of missiles. I am tired of everywhere being crowded. I hope the war stops. I hope that the world hears our voices. According to Al Jazeera English, newborn babies wrapped in blankets and lined up on a bed after being removed from incubators have become the defining image showing the Zionist regime's siege of hospitals in the Gaza Strip. At least 32 hospitals, including 6 premature babies, have died at the Al-Shifa hospital in the last few days. Palestinian Health Ministry spokesperson Ashraf Al-Ghodra said recently as Gaza's largest medical facility was forced to shut down due to lack of fuel and medicine. More than 100 babies are decomposing inside the hospital, waiting to be buried. Tedros Adhanom, the Director General of the World Health Organization, said, regrettably, the hospital is not functioning as a hospital anymore. The world cannot stand silent while hospitals, which should be safe havens, are transformed into scenes of death, devastation, and despair.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. On the threshold of the blessed birthday anniversary of the heroine of Karbala, the Holy Prophet's granddaughter, Hazrat Zainab Kubra, peace be upon her, here is a statement from her on the God-given status of the Immaculate Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. By God that He has honored us with revelation of the book, with prophethood, and His approved vicegerents.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, what is conceit? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Conceit means to have an exaggerated opinion of oneself, to be pleased with oneself, vanity, and egoism. This is primarily what conceit is. When somebody starts loving themselves, you know, starts looking up to themselves, starts thinking that they are someone special. And, you know, everybody has some sort of qualities, but these people who are conceitful, they fall in this trap of looking at themselves in a magnified form and, you know, something that is bigger than themselves, right? So this opinion of having an exaggerated view of oneself is known as conceit. Now, what could be the root cause of conceit, you know, one may ask? Because of some superiority in one's thought or success in one's action, they can fall in this trap of conceit. You know, usually it is when somebody gains some sort of a fame or some sort of a success in one of the areas that they're involved in their actions or in terms of their activity, they are more prone to falling in this trap of conceit. It is a harmful quality and has been condemned and forbidden by Islam. Conceit is not something that Islam approves of for a mu'min, a believer. So at any cost, a believer is supposed to and required to stay away from conceit. And the origin of conceit in most people is ignorance. You know, it is based on them not knowing the realities. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing about conceit. And we said Islam disapproves of conceit. Islam does not expect a believer to carry the vice of conceit. A conceited man has come up short in knowing about the Lord and His greatness and in realizing his own need and dependence on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For this reason, he is proud of his material and spiritual capabilities and boasts about his successfulness in thought and action. You know, when they become a little famous or a little, you know, successful in whatever they're doing, they start to exaggerate their own stature, right? This is what conceit is. And this is primarily because they do not realize that there is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And when it comes to us comparing ourselves to Allah, we see that we are no ones, right? And this is how you stay humble. You know, conceit is something that takes away that humility from you. This person who is, you know, a victim of conceit is unaware of the fact that all kinds of perfection and capacity as well as material favors are from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And all sorts of good deeds and success in man's life comes from Him. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran says, "And whatever favor is bestowed on you, it is from Allah." So this realization is vital for any believer. And this realization is the only way and the only method through which one can truly stay away from conceit. One can avoid conceit. One cannot carry this vice in their lives. So let's, inshallah, try to realize that all the goodness, all of the qualities that I possess as a human being, they are from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
IRIB English Radio, Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Israel's complex and uncertain future.
Part 1.
Kibbutzim, hailed by many Israelis as paradisiacal havens, stand as enduring symbols of resilience and human ingenuity. These lands were originally owned by Palestinians, but now these kibbutzim have transformed into the hubs of industry and agriculture for the Israelis. Kibbutzim feature lush gardens, fertile fields, and modern amenities. A stroll through these paradisiacal spaces reveals a blend of fragrant flowers and joyful children, creating an atmosphere of peace and prosperity. Inhabitants enjoy a high standard of living with quality homes, excellent schools, and healthcare services. Meanwhile, just a few miles away lies the Gaza Strip, where a markedly contrasting reality unfolds. The people of Gaza have endured a protracted period of severe hardship, grappling with profound deprivation due to the constraints imposed upon them by Israel. Even the simple act of fishing along their shores has become an arduous endeavor, burdened by stringent restrictions enforced by Israelis. However, on Saturday, October 7th, the calm in Kibbutzim was shattered when Hamas fighters mounted a daring challenge to Israel's perceived military might, altering the world's perception of the situation. The skies, usually pristine, became cloaked in smoke as paragliders bearing these fighters swooped down. Simultaneously on the ground, a relentless wave of heavily armed fighters, many on motorcycles, followed bulldozers that brazenly breached the fortified fences separating Israel from Gaza. This wasn't all. The lightning-quick, multi-pronged ambush also included dozens of Hamas fighters on motorboats who descended upon Israeli beaches. They stormed into cities, catching Israeli soldiers off guard and leaving settlers in a state of shock. This was not the Iron Dome they had envisioned. Israel's Iron Dome serves as a shield against relentless rocket attacks, safeguarding settlers from groups like Hamas and Hezbollah. Equipped with advanced radar and tracking systems, it detects and intercepts incoming rockets, claiming to have a success rate of approximately 90%. During a recent visit by OpenAI CEO Sam Altman to Tel Aviv University, Israel made a deliberate effort to showcase its technological prowess, presenting innovations like the Iron Dome as a display of pride, even if it may not have been as groundbreaking as suggested. Israel has wielded the Iron Dome not only as a defense mechanism, but also as a diplomatic tool, projecting an image of security and deterrence on the global stage. Other nations, such as South Korea, have sought to develop similar missile systems. Saturday, October 7th, marked a pivotal moment in Israeli history as the Palestinian resistance group Hamas executed an extraordinary multifaceted attack. Employing a calculated campaign of deception, Hamas managed to catch Israel off guard with a devastating assault. Their forces, utilizing bulldozers, hand gliders, and motorbikes, confronted the formidable Israeli military. This Saturday assault represents the most significant breach in Israel since the Arab Army's 1973 conflict. It came after 2 years of careful planning by Hamas, marked by military secrecy and convincing Israel that they sought no confrontation. Israel acknowledges being taken by surprise by an attack timed to coincide with the Jewish Sabbath and a religious holiday. Major Nir Dinar, spokesperson for the Israeli military, admitted, "They surprised us and they came fast from many spots, both from the air and the ground and the sea." Israeli Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi has also publicly acknowledged shortcomings related to the Hamas operation. Here's how the operation, named Al-Aqsa Flood, was executed. An initial barrage included two stages. In the first stage, more than 3,000 rockets rained down on various Israeli settlements within a mere 6 hours. These targeted barracks, outposts, and checkpoints, forcing Israeli soldiers to seek refuge. During the second stage, an additional 2,000 rockets were launched, primarily targeting the same objectives. The rockets streaked through the sky and began raining down on specific targets in Israel. After penetrating the Iron Dome, inflicting extensive damage and casualties, it instilled a profound sense of fear, prompting thousands of Israelis to urgently seek refuge. But this was merely a diversion, the prelude to a meticulously coordinated operation. As the resistance fighters, aided by first-person view drones and grenades, systematically seized dozens of observation towers held by the Israelis, their complex operation unfolded. In the next phase, over 25 barracks and outposts fell under their control, achieving all their objectives with impressive success. In this critical phase, they captured the Kerem Shalom military site, leading to the destruction of several Merkava tanks and the apprehension of their crews. Many of these tanks were from the site, and numerous seized trophies were transported back to Gaza. Simultaneously with paragliders, they managed to bypass the formidable Israeli military fortifications erected along the Gaza borders and launch assaults from unexpected directions. By neutralizing these fortifications, they paved the way for other fighters to strike Israeli outposts. This strategic approach allowed them to penetrate up to 25 miles deep into the occupied territories on the very first day of the operation. Video footage shared on social media captured the dramatic scene of Hamas fighters descending via paragliders near one of these so-called paradises named Re'im Kibbutz, located approximately 3.3 miles from the wall that demarcates the boundary between Gaza and southern occupied territories. As the next phase started, Hamas fighters executed a swift and highly precise operation, successfully capturing various camps and kibbutzim all at once. They advanced towards Kibbutz Be'eri, taking advantage of the early morning hours when many Israelis either sought shelter from the ongoing rocket attacks or were asleep. Other destinations included the Nahal Oz camp, where robust Israeli resistance was met, but eventually overcome, yielding significant trophies transported to Gaza. As they pushed toward Kafar Aza, the fighters encountered determined resistance. Capturing this location proved a formidable challenge, but they persevered, securing Kafar Aza and acquiring numerous trophies for transport to Gaza. Strategically crucial was the Erez crossing, a major entrance to Gaza. The wide expanse provided numerous trophies, and many Israeli officers lost their lives or were captured. With captured bulldozers, the fighters disrupted the walls and fences of the Gaza Strip at multiple locations, disorienting Israeli forces and impeding their strength and reaction times. As barriers were breached, the fighters started the next phase of the attack, simultaneously advancing into urban areas and capturing police stations. In the city of Sderot, they took control of the police outpost, inflicting heavy casualties on Israeli personnel. Ashkelon was another important target. The resistance fighters marched through its streets, their actions vividly documented in history. This marks the moment when a new element came into play, the speedboats.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The blatant attempts by the U.S. government and the mainstream American media to parrot ridiculous Israeli lies about the ongoing genocide in the besieged Gaza Strip have seriously backfired. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, the blatant attempts by the U.S. government have included projecting the occupying Zionist regime that has wreaked havoc in the densely populated coastal territory of 2.2 million people since October 7th as victims. However, Americans have refused to fall into trap this time, coming out in large numbers in different states, including Washington, D.C., to express solidarity with Palestinians and condemn the Zionist regime. One of the largest pro-Palestine rallies was witnessed recently in the American capital city, which came amid reports of growing divisions over the Gaza war within the ruling Democratic Party. The massive protest against the Zionist regime's genocidal attacks against Palestinians in the besieged Strip and Washington's continued support for the Zionist regime and its pledge to give $14 billion more in military aid brought together over 150,000 people of diverse faiths and nationalities from across the U.S. It is widely agreed that the massive show of support by people who are angered by the carnage of mostly Palestinian women and children in Gaza was a direct outcome of the propaganda campaign orchestrated by U.S. officials and media in a bid to whitewash the Zionist regime's war crimes. The official pro-Israel publicity campaign and declaration of all-out support for Tel Aviv's war machine came in the face of widely shared accounts and documented evidence on social media platforms of indiscriminate bombings and other war crimes perpetrated by the Zionist regime against Gazans. While the state-sponsored American media outlets conveniently ignored or censored previously held protest rallies against Gaza genocide in major cities across the U.S., ignoring the latest and unarguably unprecedented pro-Palestine demonstration in D.C. wasn't possible. Pro-Palestine protests have also been reported in other U.S. states, including California, New York, Ohio, Utah, Michigan, and Pennsylvania in recent weeks. such tremendous outpouring of support for Palestine has come despite attempts by a massive network of pro-Israel lobby groups and propaganda institutions across the U.S. to identify and blacklist the demonstrators as anti-Semitic, which would result in their potential dismissal from jobs. Protest organizers in Washington had cautioned the participants after media reports that students in New York saw their job offers being revoked for taking part in pro-Palestinian events and rallies. The state of New York is home to the largest population of Zionist Jews in the U.S. who share close ties with the Israeli regime and hold dual citizenship of the occupying entity. The remarkable show of support for Palestine in a country that officially prides itself on its unreserved support for the apartheid Israeli regime comes amid reports of growing divisions among politicians and lawmakers affiliated with the ruling Democratic Party. The divisions have been fueled by Joe Biden administration's all-out push to defend and justify the ongoing genocide in Gaza by the Zionist regime. One of the oft-repeated slogans during the recent protest march referred to U.S. President Joe Biden as Genocide Joe. This is while the pro-Israel news outlet Axios, seen by many as affiliated with the ruling party, reported recently that Biden's political team is in turmoil over the regime's war with Hamas resistance group. Infighting is spreading, slowly but meaningfully, at every layer of the Democratic Party over Biden's full-throated support of Israel, the outlet reported recently, insisting that it runs much deeper than college campus protests or scathing remarks uttered by elected officials. Pro-Palestinian Democrats, it conceded, are outraged at the persisting carnage in Gaza and believe that it has been facilitated by Biden's open support for the Tel Aviv regime. Many liberal Jews, on the other hand, are furious that so many progressive Democrats aren't more outraged by the unprecedented Hamas operation that inflicted heavy losses on the Israeli military threatening to leave the party. The report further pointed out that nearly 20% of the 300 employees of the Democratic National Committee, DNC, have signed a letter calling on their boss, Biden, to demand a ceasefire. Additionally, a U.S. State Department Foreign Affairs officer sent a massive internal email to organize a dissent cable on the administration's Israel policy, insisting in a social media post that Biden is complicit in genocide in Gaza. Day after day, the report emphasized more Democrats in the House of Representatives are expressing growing concerns over Biden's pro-Israel policy and slamming Tel Aviv's aggression against Gaza. The report went on to describe Biden's war planning team as pro-Israel across the board, but hastened to caution that top Biden administration officials know their own party decidedly does not favor the Tel Aviv regime and remain deeply divided over Israel's leadership and Gaza strategy. The hasty move by the Biden administration and the U.S. corporate media empire to openly back and justify the brutal Israeli regime terrorism against the defenseless civilian population in Gaza is a blunder that is already backfiring. It will ultimately expose the true and historic nature of the U.S. foreign policy in perpetrating and justifying military aggressions, foreign interference, war crimes, and racism across the world. By all indications, Biden stands no chance to return to office in 2024 amid growing divisions within the ruling party and enormous dissatisfied voters who regret casting their ballot for a deceptive politician. The mainstream U.S. propaganda machine will also continue to lose audiences amid rising awareness among the masses who are now relying more on alternative sources to obtain reliable information. According to Crescent International, Ross Siegel, Associate Professor of Genocide Studies at Stockton University in New Jersey, asserts the Zionist regime's assault on Gaza is a textbook case of genocide unfolding in front of our eyes. He views the enablers of Israel's genocide as partners in crime. Leading the pack of the Zionist regime's enablers is first and foremost the U.S. that finances and arms the Zionist regime. America also provides political and diplomatic cover to Israel and has repeatedly used its veto power to block censure of the Zionist entity at the United Nations Security Council. Other regimes include Britain, France, Germany, and a host of others in Europe as well as Canada. These rulers are complicit in Israeli regime war crimes and also liable. They will be held accountable for their support for the Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza. Midstream.
The Palestinian resistance Hamas is dealing very cautiously with the U.S.-Israeli entity proposals regarding what is referred to as the humanitarian ceasefire. So far, mediators had not reached an agreement accepted by all parties. The situation became clearer with the White House's announcement of a daily four-hour ceasefire, but then Zionist Israel quickly clarified that it does not imply a cessation of military operations. You see, the U.S. proposal for a temporary four-hour ceasefire daily was a response to the desires of the Zionist regime, which does not want a ceasefire that could be seen as an achievement for the resistance or have negative implications on the political situation within Zionist Israel, internationally, as well as on the military level. Whichever way you look at it, Washington aims for one goal, pushing the Palestinian resistance of northern Gaza to leave towards the south, in line with the basic plan to displace all the inhabitants of the Gaza Strip. Washington is basically telling Palestinians to leave or die. The resistance in the Gaza Strip has already made it clear that it will not compel anyone to stay or move from the north to the south. The resistance already views this proposal as additional U.S. support for the Zionist regime, since it does not provide a comprehensive cessation of military operations and prohibits the provision of genuine humanitarian support to the Gaza population. The Zionist regime is now requesting more time to achieve field accomplishments that would present the Israeli occupation army with an image of victory. They emphasize that the idea of displacing the population of the Gaza Strip to the south practically means clearing the way for the occupation army to launch a more intensive destructive operation in the entire north, absolving them of any accountability for the carnage under the pretext of the absence of civilians.